Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook.
Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business or nonprofit, go to our website at TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com for details. Man, we have another great show in store for you today. So sound the alarm. Get on Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare, or Tumblr. Send out emails and text messages. Call your friends and family and tell them to tune in right now to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And for those of you that are listening via Blog Talk Radio, leave your comments. Click the follow button or follow me on Twitter. And that's at TaylorMade101. I'll be reading your tweets live on the air. And I also have a chat room open. Out there in the chat room, you can leave your comments or ask questions. So whatever your pleasure, chat room, Twitter, Facebook, or just plain old my bell, we want to hear from you. But first, let's take a look at the current events. Greetings and salutations, everyone. Greetings and salutations. We have another great show in store for you today. So let's take a look at what's on tap today. We want to talk about Memorial Day. In fact, I want to kind of share my thoughts with you as well as what the president had to say in his address. And I want to talk a little bit about a couple of things that are going on around the nation. And then, of course, at the top of the hour, we will look at Black Acre. We will take a listen to Stephen A. Smith's rant that he talked about regarding Mark Cuban's statement. And I want to take a look at something, an article that was posted called The Case for Reparations. I want to get your feedback on that. So we will discuss this and much, much more. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And now to help me break all of this down is the executive producer, as well as the chief operating officer for Current Events, and also the author of What I Know to Be True, or Reflections, What I Know to Be True. I introduce to some and present to others, no other than Jima Hill Cook. Okay, now Jimmy will be joining us here shortly, but I want to take a moment to talk about Memorial Day. And it's something I want to kind of defer. Take a look back at what Memorial Day means to at least the official definition of Memorial Day, right? It is, according to Wikipedia, Memorial Day is a federal holiday wherein the men and women who died while serving the United States Armed Forces are remembered. The holiday, which is celebrated every year on the final Monday of May, was formerly known as Decoration Day and originated after the American Civil War. to commemorate the Union and Confederate soldiers who died in the Civil War. By the 20th century, Memorial Day had been extended to honor all Americans who have died while in the military service. It typically marks the start of the summer vacation season, while Labor Day marks the end. Many people visit cemeteries and memorials, particularly to honor those who have died in military service. Many volunteers place an American flag on each grave in national cemeteries. Annual decoration days for particular cemeteries are held on a Sunday in late spring or early summer in some rural areas of the American South, notably in the mountains, in cases involving a family graveyard where remote ancestors as well as those who were deceased more recently are buried. Now, what's interesting about this holiday is kind of the history behind the holiday. Now, the practice of decorating soldiers' graves with flowers is an ancient custom, and we are pretty much familiar with that. But soldiers' graves were decorated in the U.S. before and during the American Civil War. A claim was made in 1906 that the first Civil War soldier's grave ever decorated was in Warrenton, Virginia, on June 3, 1861, implying the first Memorial Day occurred there. Though not for Union soldiers, there is authentic documentation that women in Savannah, Georgia, decorated Confederate soldiers' graves in 1862. Now, in 1863, the cemetery dedication at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, was a ceremony in commemoration at the graves of dead soldiers. Local historians in Pennsylvania claim that ladies there decorated soldiers' graves on July 4th, 1864, as a result. Now, what's interesting is that there's a comment by David W. Blight that describes the day this way. This was the first Memorial Day. African Americans invented Memorial Day in Charleston, South Carolina. What you have there is Black Americans recently freed from slavery announcing to the world with their flowers, their feet, and their songs what the war had been about. What they basically were creating was Independence Day of a second American Revolution. Now, there's Blight stated he has no evidence that this event in Charleston inspired the establishment of Memorial Day, but it did happen. So there's a lot of conversation around the issue whether or not the first Memorial Day was started by African Americans. So I want to now welcome our co-host, Jima, to the show. Jima, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, I want to start by saying I described it as a day. I talked about Wikipedia's description of Memorial Day, and I talked about the African Americans' contribution to this day. However, I would like to describe it as a day to reflect on the ultimate sacrifice many have made while others enjoy the fruits of their labor, if you will. But what's interesting is that many will spend the day relaxing on the beach, barbecuing, or even celebrating with plenty of the natural resources in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado, or gallons upon gallons of spirits from the local package store. Now, I wonder, is this really the way we should be paying homage to our men and women in the armed forces? So I want to get you to respond, but first I want to take a moment to listen to what the president had to say, and then I want to get you to respond. Take a listen.
Hi, everybody. It's Memorial Day weekend. A chance for Americans to get together with family and friends, break out the grill, and kick off the unofficial start of summer. More importantly, it's a time to remember the heroes whose sacrifices made these moments possible, our men and women in uniform who gave their lives to keep our nation safe and free. from those shots fired at Lexington and Concord more than two centuries ago, to our newest generation of veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, our history shines with patriots who answered the call to serve. They put their lives on the line to defend the country they love. And in the end, many gave that last full measure of devotion so that our nation would endure. Every single one of us owes our fallen heroes a profound debt of gratitude. Because every time we cast our votes or speak our mind without fear, it's because they fought for our right to do that. Every chance we get to make a better life for ourselves and our families is possible because generations of patriots fought to keep America a land of opportunity, where anyone of any race, any religion, from any background can make it if they try. Our country was born out of a desire to be free, and every day since, it's been protected by our men and women in uniform. People who believed so deeply in America, they were willing to give their lives for it. We owe them so much. So this Memorial Day, we'll gather together as Americans to honor the fallen with both public ceremonies and private remembrances. And I hope all Americans will take a moment this weekend to think of those who have died in service to our nation. Say a prayer in their memories and for their families. Lay a flower where they've come to rest. Reach out to service members, military families, or veterans in your community, or families who've lost a loved one, and let them know that their service and sacrifice will never be forgotten. Most of all, let's keep working to make sure that our country upholds our sacred trust to all who've served. In recent weeks, we've seen again how much more our nation has to do to make sure all our veterans get the care they deserve. And as Commander-in-Chief, I believe that taking care of our veterans and their families is a sacred obligation. It's been one of the causes of my presidency. And now that we've ended the war in Iraq, and as our war in Afghanistan ends as well, we have to work even harder as a nation to make sure all our veterans get the benefits and opportunities that they have earned. They've done their duty, and they ask nothing more than that this country does ours, now and for decades to come. Happy Memorial Day, everybody. May God watch over our fallen heroes, and may He continue to bless the United States of America.
Okay. So there was a lot packed into the president's comments, as always. He's a very, very articulate, and I'm using the non-racist description of that word. He's also very well versed in his comments. I mean, he does the history. I mean, he's a well-informed person. So I want to start by first asking the question about a statement he made when he said that many gave the last full measure of devotion. Do we give an equitable contribution to our men and women in service when it comes to giving their equitable, when it comes to giving that full measure of devotion?
Well, I'm going to say no, because I think it's interesting. I believe it was during the campaign and the I don't want to say program, but what's on the First Lady's agenda and Dr. Jill Biden's agenda around veterans and families is that what they found in research is how far removed people are from actually knowing somebody in the military, and or even far removed people are from having served, whereas in years past, you know, there was more of a connection there. And I think it was yesterday in watching Reverend Jesse Jackson and Rainbow Push meeting where he said, we love our soldiers. We love to see them go off, but we have a lack of respect for our veterans. And I thought that was profound in such a way, in that, you know, we salute them when they're heading off to war, and we're supportive of them while they're on foreign soil. And yet when they come home, when they need our support most, we tend to, shy away from them. And we know, according to the data and reports that have come out, the amount of veterans that are homeless that suffer from an array of mental health issues and addiction issues. And so, you know, I don't think we give them the level of respect and or concern that we should, considering it is, you know, an ultimate sacrifice to leave your home, leave your family. Although you made a decision, and I know that's what somebody's going to say, to join, but we are forever grateful that you did join. Thus, I didn't have to. You know what I'm saying? I mean, so although it's a choice, if it wasn't a choice, then it'd go back to the draft situation, and everybody would, you know, whoever could go would have to go. So I think because of that, we do owe them a lot more. And I don't think we look at it that way. We look at it as, oh, they chose to go in the military, so they knew the possibility that they might be going to war, and we push it off at to some other level, as opposed to, in my opinion, the level that it needs to be.
You know, it was interesting about that, and I think to your point about it being a choice, meaning that is a volunteer service. But I look at it a little differently by saying that it's an attitude of service, an attitude of servitude, as opposed to just being a choice to go in when you have other choices to bring forth. And I say the attitude of servitude because we do have a democracy. We do have a country in which, by all intents and purposes, has a free society. Now, that word could be parsed and unpacked a little bit to really talk about what freedom really means. But for the most part, we are a free society, and it is because of the work that is done by the soldier that we are able to enjoy that freedom. And so although, you know, if it is looked upon as a volunteering service and you want to talk about being a choice to go in, I think that choice is a major choice because it is one of that enables everyone else to be able to have ultimate choices to do pretty much what they're doing today. And so, I want to say that, you know, that the people that are going into the military, and myself included, I spent over a decade in the United States Army. I fought in combat. You know, I was telling the young kids the other day, I jumped out of helicopters. I rappelled down mountains. You know, I low crawled. I was, you know, I've been fired upon, you know, and I've, you know, been injured while I was in the military. So there's a couple of things, you know, physically and wounded, you know, while in combat. So, I mean, you know, not to the point where I was in catastrophic situations, but I mean, you know, I mean, all of those things happen while you and I was spent time overseas, time away from my family, you know, so I understand personally the sacrifices made by the soldiers. And of course, I did not, you know, give that last full measure of devotion that the Lord had covered me as he has covered so many others and has not called me home yet. But I was able to participate in all of those activities. And so to see, you know, all of those things happen and for us as Americans to kind of, you know, not really, you know, understand the magnitude or the scope in which the soldier, you know, goes through, it's perplexing to say the least. For them to, they're always celebrating the troops and waving the flag, but yet and still we have a situation that's going on in the VA hospital. We have a situation where you mentioned we have VA veterans that are homeless. You know, we have a situation where, you know, they're in a lot of cases. Have a mental state that's not being attended to, so it's kind of strange to me that we you know, at least give lip service to supporting our troops, but I don't know if we put in the actions behind it.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think we put enough actions behind it, and I think we, as with everything that I'm sure we're going to end up talking about today, a lot of what we do as it relates to groups of people is reactionary. You know, there's this thing that we do in business that's called strategic planning, there's and what's interesting is I remember when I was still working 4 years ago, which means about 5-6 years ago, the Department of Defense had put out notifications that they were looking for people to go back to school to get either licensed social workers or MSWs or counselors, because they knew that they would need an influx of those people in those professions to help with the returning veterans when they came back. And so here we sit 6 years later, and I don't think that void has been filled. As a matter of fact, I know it hasn't been filled. And so that was some forward thinking to think about what, you know, what the need could potentially be. But then we didn't do anything with it. You know, whoever had the power to hire the people or send the people back to school or get them the certification they need or whatever to make it more topical, because whenever I say that to people, they like, really? They did that? And these are people that are in the field that hadn't heard about it. They were willing to send you even overseas because they knew where the needs were going to be. And so it's amazing, as you say. We talk about it. On some level, we do some forward thinking, but then it stays during the thought process. It doesn't move into action. And that's, you know, what makes the situation that's happening at the various VA hospitals disheartening and perplexing, because it didn't need to happen. And if nobody in the building, nobody sitting at the table had enough in them to stand up to say this is wrong, then who are we hiring? You know, who are these people whose souls are empty, that they can't see that this is such a need that we have, that we need to ensure, you know, that all people are well taken care of, but definitely those who come back to us less than they were when they left us. And not less, but less physically less, those that are injured, those that have some mental scars that we don't even see that they didn't have when they went over or when they joined, we should definitely, you know, try to take care of them for sure.
So what do you think, perhaps, is the disconnect between civilian and the military population in so much as to not be able to really focus in on the needs of the military? Because it is the civilians that really, in some regards, you know, provide the services or provide the support in that in which the military ultimately obtains in some capacity. So what is the disconnect between the civilian and the military community so that the military is not getting the support they need?
I don't know. I think that's, you know, that's the basic first tier question. And the second, but you know, underneath that question in terms of what the disconnect is, why is there a disconnect? You know, what is causing the disconnect is probably a better question, where we don't see the need for these types of services to be provided, or that we shun. And this goes back generations. I mean, they did it to Vietnam, and maybe those, I mean, and I think, you know, things stay around and linger around and fester and grow when they're left unchallenged and unchecked. And so, you know, the Vietnam War was an ugly war, was a nasty war, and people, you know, the country was split on that war. And so some of those attitudes was about, you know, let them get it where they can. And that wasn't, you know, that wasn't right then, no more than it's right today. And so I think because of how things linger around in a thought process, and then you hear it 20 years later, and you're like, that's the same thing they were saying 20 years ago. How are we still saying that 20 years later? How are we still thinking that 20 years later? You know, how have we not grown as a nation 20 years later when we're considered, may not necessarily be true, but considered to be, you know, the land of opportunity and have all these resources and access to all of these things, and yet we have those among us. We have, you know, the highest prison population, got the highest homeless population, I believe, and we have all of these ills, but yet we're supposed to be so great and mighty, and we can't take care of those that have served their country to the fullest in terms of not only if they lost their life, but if they lost a limb, if they lost their mind, if they lost, you know, whatever they lost, we don't take care of them. And so where, you're right, you know, what is the disconnect? I don't know, but why is there a disconnect? Why would you not have concern for somebody that has done something that you yourself was not willing to do? How could you not be concerned and care about somebody that did something that you didn't have to do? Because it is, you know, a volunteer service, and you chose not to go and serve and volunteer, but somebody else did, and because they did, sit here and do what you do and not worry about somebody busting in your door telling you you can't watch whatever you're watching on TV. So why is there a disconnect? What is causing us to be that disconnected from one another as a race of people? I don't know.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, I want to talk to you a little bit about paying some of the respects to some of the people that have gone on before us. And I'll give you an opportunity to give your own personal tribute to on this Memorial Day. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
You are listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. My mom and dad will be right back after these messages.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Shima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy, and I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend, and of course, my Eastbourne friend.
Need a new website? Haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, a number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Jima, I now want to kind of turn to some of the I want to say traditions of Memorial Day. I want to know particularly how you used to celebrate this day over the years, and in the context of the actual knowledge of the day, and then just to pose it up against how you used to celebrate it, right? Did you used to take what you know now and you incorporate it in how you celebrated in the past, and how would you now celebrate it in the future?
Okay, so there's several things. I did have several members in my family. I had two uncles that were in the Navy. So Memorial Day was often about, I mean, they didn't die, they're still here. So we would often, you know, call and say something to them on Memorial Day and thank them or whatever. So we always did that growing up. And just from a historical standpoint, it was a matter of just remembering those that fought for our freedom and that died in that battle. And so I've always known it to be about those who died in service. In protecting the rights of others. So I've always known that, and I've always tried to keep that somewhere close. As we got older and we began to lose members of our family to death, it became also a celebration of life for those in our family that had passed on in the previous year or whatever. And so we would often go out to the cemetery and lay flowers at the gravesite of our family members that had passed. Or my mom would just go, even if we didn't have anybody out there, we would just go out to the cemetery. I never quite understood that, but I think because we didn't have where we were, that wasn't a close military place to go, so we would just go to a cemetery. And just say a prayer or whatever and lay flowers on somebody's grave and then go on back home. And that's just kind of what we used to do. But then I said, as we began to lose our own members of our family, we would go out to the cemetery and place flowers on their grave site. So that's kind of what we've done over the years, through years as I've grown up. If ever I'm home, I know that's the first thing my mother does on Memorial Day morning is go out to the cemetery to place flowers on my grandmother's grave and my sister's now and my brother now and my brother that just passed in November. So this would be her first time going out there without him. Don used to be the one that would get Mama early in the morning and make sure she got out there. So tomorrow is going to be a difficult day. The weekend has been difficult for me because of traditions in my family and what normally we do during this time and how vital and important Don was during this time, because it also leads into his birthday in a couple of days. And so this was always a big, you know, celebration of life as well as remembrance. And so this is going to be a hard time to get through this weekend and definitely tomorrow, but that's how we honor those that had gone on before us.
You know, I think that first of all, let me say, I definitely empathize with your sentiments there. I know, but it is something that strikes me as amazing that your family does that. I know very few families that go out and at least pay homage to people, even though if they don't have anybody out there to go out there and pay homage, let alone to go out and do it for the people that they do know and love. So first, let me tip my hat to you and your family for taking that tradition upon yourselves and doing it for many, many years. I want to say, though, that when you look at historically, at least where I'm from, we didn't do that to my remembrance. We would take the time to go to the store, load up on as many spirits as that was available, get as many ribs and get as many parts of the pig that was available, and we would light up the grill and get out there and just barbecue and play music and have fun. And we celebrated what the president called the unofficial beginning of summer more than we would pay homage to the people that had spent time in the military or the people that had gone on in the past. So, but I find that today, for me to now, knowing what I know now, to reflect more on the aspects of the day, of the holiday, to do as what you would call in your book, to reflect and to really think about what I know to be true, as opposed to going out and just, spending time playing music, barbecuing, things of that nature, because very seldom do we get an opportunity to do just that, to just reflect and to take in what we know to be true, as opposed to just going out and celebrating, because it is true that the people that has been here before us and has done all those wonderful things, we do pay them a debt of gratitude. And I don't know if we do enough of that, to really pay our respects to them. So again, I applaud you and your family for taking that on and doing that for so many years. Now, when you talk about in the 21st century, and the fact that many people are connected, many people at least are more informed about the activities of the day. Jima, do you think there's a difference in the way people celebrated, back in your time, a few generations ago? Or would you say that, recently people look at it a little differently?
I'm not really sure about my few generations ago. However, I will say that it is a combination of both. I mean, it's just like Thanksgiving dinner. It's just like Christmas. You get up on Thanksgiving, and most tradition families go to church on Thanksgiving morning. You're giving thanks to God for allowing you to see such another day, another special day. And then you come home and you have this big meal and to celebrate the feast and the holiday. Christmas morning, the same thing. You get up and you do the gift sharing. You go to church that morning and you talk about, the greatest gift of all. And then, you come home and you partake in some food and some more gifts exchange. And so as it is, with most things, we have, you can mesh the two together in my world in terms of honoring it for what it was originally put here for and why we celebrate it. And then, adding your own twist to it. And so the barbecuing and everything, we did that as well. We wasn't somber all day. We enjoyed each other's company and we enjoyed the food and the fellowship and the fun. And so I think what we have to do, though, is so that we don't lose sight of why we do. So many times we do things, and we don't know why we do them. So I was taught why we went out to the cemetery, even though we didn't have anybody out there, because it was out of respect for those whose lives had been lost and what Memorial Day was really all about. So when I can have that conversation because I have something, connected to it. So when we do get back home and Daddy's firing up the grill or my brother's firing up the grill, that makes sense to me, because now it's time to eat and it's time to enjoy each other's company. So we paid homage. We've given our respect. We remember the moment as to why we're here. And so now let's celebrate in that moment as well. Let's celebrate life. And so I think that's what, we have to be careful of is that we don't do more celebration of life and in its present time and forget about the valleys that we came through to get to this point.
Yeah, that's a true statement. You know, we do spend a lot of time, you know, looking at you know, those issues, and I can appreciate where you're going with that. You know, I wonder, though, you know, is do more people know why they celebrate? I mean, you know, you mentioned the fact that people do a lot and don't realize why they do things. You know, is that commonplace today that people still don't know why they celebrate the way they do?
I think so. But I think since we've been in war for the last however many long years it's been now, at least 12, 15 years or whatever, I think now people are getting back to remembering why we celebrate and why we have Memorial Day. I think during those years of where we wasn't in a war like the one we've just coming out of and trying to come out of in Afghanistan, that I think people had forgotten about Memorial Day and why it was originally started. And it even goes back to, I mean, we talk about this for all of our holidays. We even talked about this for MLK Day. You know, why was that day set aside to celebrate? It was to celebrate his life. And yet it's another sale day at the mall. It's another party day. It's a day off. Everybody's doing what they're doing. But, you know, since we've had President and First Lady, and they've tried to make it be a day of service, you know, because he was a man that served. And so we should try to embody that on that day. And I think, you know, what we forget is we forget because it's not maintained in the forefront. It's for a fleeting moment, and then nobody's talking about it anymore. And so if we keep our veterans in front of us, then the things that have happened wouldn't happen because they'll always be in front and not behind. The memory of Dr. King in front of us, then the fact that he was born and died to do in the short period of time he lived on this side, what he accomplished, if we keep that in front of us, then we'll remember that, you know, the I Have a Dream speech was really about. What was it really about? Economic freedom and equality and justice. So if we keep that in front of us and not behind, then we wouldn't get a prison population like we have. We wouldn't have unjust laws on the books that have disparity between crack cocaine and cocaine. We wouldn't have, you know, young men being arrested and stopped and frisked for no reason except for the color of their skin, because he talked about all of that. But if we don't keep it in front of us and if we allow it to fade to the back, then we have all these things and we forget why we're even doing it. And so that's why it's important to remember the reasons why. Just as though it's important to remember Memorial Day, it's important to remember Veterans Day. It's important to remember, you know, those that came back to us and why we should be taking care of them, because of the same reason why those that did make it back, we should take care of their families. So I think it's important to continue to keep those things in front of us, because that's what's going to keep it where it's real to us, and we can have something to hold on to and something to remind us as to why we do what we do.
Yeah, I agree with that. All right, now it's time for the hot searches. What's going on in Trinidad and Google? So let's take a look at the top 10. All right, up first, we got T.I. and Floyd Mayweather. Jima, what is going on here? Have you seen this? That was a brawl.
Okay.
That took place between...
I haven't seen the brawl, but I've read Floyd Mayweather's statement. And basically, you know, I don't even know how to go with this, because although I read Floyd's statement, on the one hand, it sounded real mature what he was saying, but this is the same dude that a couple weeks ago put out all this stuff about his ex-wife and some abortion and all this crazy stuff. So I don't know how above board he really was in this whole altercation with T.I. Obviously, something didn't go right the first time they had a conversation, because he claimed he and T.I. had a conversation in New York. And T.I. walked up to him and said, "Yo, dude, let me holler at you for a moment." And they went outside and they were talking about Tiny and her friend that came out there to the fight and all this kind of stuff. And so he's like, you know, I hear you, dude, but it ain't really nothing like that. And so then when T.I. approaches him now out there in Vegas, you know, Floyd is kind of like, dude, you know, I ain't finna go talk to you. Now he's fronting on T.I. in front of everybody. And then T.I. was like, dude, I'm with you, you know, why you got to be all out? And, you know, Floyd flexed, you know, dude, you know, this is what I do for a living. You sure you want to come at me like that? And T.I. was like, what you do in the ring, what I do on the street. So, you know, they got this, all this. Now, this is according to Floyd. It's what Floyd said in his statement. So I really don't know. But, you know, I think, as you know, what married women have to remember is that it's a different set of standards and a different set of rules when you're a married woman and when you're a married man. And we just got to understand that. So there's probably some things Tiny shouldn't be doing and T.I.'s not around, i.e. going to Vegas with your girl during a fight weekend. Nothing may not have happened, but you just left the gate wide open for possession.
So what's interesting is that, you know, last week, all the hoopla about Jay-Z and Solange, and now this week about T.I., and now I hear the Game is getting involved, and, you know, I got others, you know, T.I. now, 50 Cent, you know, all of these rappers and everybody else is getting all in the mix and between this. This kind of reminds me of, you know, the East Coast, West Coast issue that we had 20 years ago in the 80s and 90s, you know. So it's bad enough that we're going through all of the racial divide that you know, that's happening in America, where, you know, you have these people that are calling us names and saying that we're not this. And then on the other hand, you have us in a lot of cases acting in this way on large scales that is really making what these people are saying, in the least giving them some validity to what they're saying. So what's happening here, and why are we behaving in this way?
I don't necessarily know if we're giving them any validity. I just think, you know, you got two men who are important on some scale because of what they do. One's a professional boxer and the champion, and one's a rapper, entertainer, or actor. You know, T.I. has branched over into some other areas, and so he's trying to do things a different kind of way. But I'm sure T.I. 5 years ago wouldn't even approach Floyd. I'm pretty sure it would have been, they would have already had the fight. You know, it wouldn't have taken, you know, this amount of time for it to go down. And so I don't think we're giving people a reason. I just think you got two men who got some huge egos, who had a conversation about something that went on a whole nother level. Now, Tiny probably should be staying out of Vegas. I'm not putting this on her, but I'm just saying. You know, two times you went to Vegas with the same young lady, and your husband and felt the need to have to say something to the man, you know, which whose company you was in. I ain't saying nothing, but I'm saying she might not need to go to Vegas without T.I. there with her. That's all I'm saying. She might pick another girl to go with. I don't know.
All right, so let's take a look at Kanye. I always want to call him K-9. But Kanye and Kim Kardashian gets married. So what's going on here?
Congratulations. That's what's going on. Congratulations. I have to say about them. I have nothing to say about Kanye or Kim. I'm not a fan of Kim Kardashian. It's not that I don't like her. I don't have an opinion about her. She is who she is, and that's that. Kanye, I used to have an affection for, and then somewhere, I don't know when it was, he just kind of went off on another level for me. Well, you know, I'm kind of still, the jury is still out as whether or not I like him yet. I don't know yet. But well, congratulations, and that's all I have to say about that.
Well, for those that don't know, the celebrity couple who had made a habit of the over-the-top public displays of affection got married Saturday in a decidedly private spot, a Renaissance fortress in Florence. The nuptials were confirmed to the Associated Press by Kardashian's representative, who noted the reporting of E! Online, the news site from the network that carries her reality show. Keeping up with the Kardashians, now E! Online reported the wedding party consists of her sisters, while stepfather Bruce Jenner walked her down the aisle. Andrea Bocelli and John Legend sang for the couple at the reception. You know, I think it's good that they went ahead and closed the deal. I mean, I think as people get older, they begin to they kind of want to settle in their ways, and all of the wild things they used to do, they kind of want to kind of. So I'm like you. Congratulations to them.
Yeah.
All right. Also trending, Miami Heat game with the Pacers, game 3. So what do you think about the comeback for Miami Heat?
Well, you're dealing with a group that's been together for a while. They've been here before. They know how to play to win, and it's like Magic said, when LeBron and Dwayne are doing what they're doing, it's going to be real easy for Ray Ray to shoot 3-pointers. Because I mean, and that's just the nature of the beast of Ray Ray. He's just gonna. You can expect there to be a game where he goes off from the 3-point line. If you know him, if you watched him, he did it in Boston. He's done it in Miami. So just expect it and know the next game he probably won't hit but 5 points. I mean, you know, it's just going to happen. But somewhere in the series, expect Ray to have a night like he had last night. Now, I do expect Indiana to win one in Miami. I expect when they go back to Indiana, it should be a tied series, but I do expect Miami to win it all. And I think it's all about defense, and Miami is better at getting in the head of Indiana, but if Indiana gets a lead, Indiana has to protect the lead. They haven't figured out how to hold it yet, and so if they do that, then, you know, this could, you know, this has the makings of being either a really great series or it'll be over in 2 games.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. All right, that's our hot searches for today. We're going to go ahead and take a quick break in just a few moments. And when we return, I want to talk a little bit about reparations. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook.
Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Shima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com. and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com. And click on Hunger Free.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday. And I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy. And I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend. And, of course, my East Bloom friend.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Current Events with Patrick Cook. Patrick Cook. Patrick Cook.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Obama is spending this Memorial Day weekend on a surprise visit to Afghanistan. NPR's Scott Horsley reports Obama hosted a rally for U.S. troops at Bagram Airfield.
The president arrived at Bagram after a secret overnight flight from Washington. He got a quick military briefing from his top commanders and the U.S. ambassador here, then headed to a giant hangar where some of the 32,000 U.S. troops now serving in Afghanistan had assembled.
I'm here on a single mission, and that is to thank you for your extraordinary service.
The president now has to decide whether to keep a small residual force of troops in Afghanistan beyond the year's end. He told commanders he expects to announce that decision fairly soon. Scott Horsley, NPR News, at the Bagram Airfield in Afghanistan.
Lawmakers from both sides of the aisle are calling for a wider investigation of problems at the Department of Veterans Affairs, that amid allegations that vets died waiting for treatment. Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal told CBS's Face the Nation the Justice Department should get involved.
We're talking now about evidence, credible and specific evidence of criminal wrongdoing across the country in more than 30 places.
His Republican counterpart, John Thune, told the same program that veterans deserve better.
This is a real tragedy. These are the people with whom we have a sacred trust, and that's been betrayed, and we need to make sure that it's fixed.
This weekend, the Obama administration also said more vets can now get care at private hospitals and clinics. Belgian officials are appealing for the public's help in finding the man who gunned down four people at the Jewish Museum in Brussels on Saturday. Terry Schultz reports security around Jewish sites is at its highest level after the attack.
The gunman walked up to the museum entrance Saturday afternoon and started shooting into the reception area, killing an Israeli couple and a French woman on the spot. A Belgian victim died Sunday in the hospital. Though there's not yet an official conclusion this was an anti-Semitic attack, the Belgian government has raised the threat level to its highest in areas where the Jewish community gathers. Officials also met with Jewish leaders to review existing protective measures. European Jewish Congress President Moshe Cantor says the attack symbolizes an overall climate of hate and incitement that exists against Jews in Europe. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
3 months after Ukrainians drove their president from power, an election today to find a new one. Long lines were snaking around polling places in Kiev, but in the eastern part of the country, pro-Russian insurgents smashed ballot boxes and blocked access into the voting centers. Polls are now closed, and while billionaire businessman Petro Poroshenko is expected to win today's vote, if the exit poll data holds up, Poroshenko will take up nearly 56% of the vote. That's a surprisingly strong showing. The first American to win the Indy 500 in 8 years, Ryan Hunter Ray, used a series of daredevil moves to beat Helio Castroneves, passing him at the Yard of Bricks at the two yellow cars raced wheel to wheel under the white flag. This is NPR. A violent holiday weekend in a popular tourist destination in South Carolina. Police say three people were killed and a fourth wounded in a shooting at a hotel in Myrtle Beach. It happened during the annual Atlantic Beach Bike Fest. No word on a motive or suspects. Poland's last communist leader has died at the age of 90. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports on the man who initially tried to stop the pro-democracy Solidarity movement.
When Wojciech Jaruzelski became Poland's prime minister in 1981, cracks were already beginning to show in communist Eastern Europe. That year, he declared martial law in Poland. Thousands of members of the reformist Solidarity movement were arrested, including its leader, Lech Wałęsa. Jaruzelski said he only declared martial law to prevent the Soviet Union from invading Poland. In 1989, he finally began negotiating with Solidarity. The next year, Wałęsa replaced Jaruzelski as Poland's leader. Jaruzelski stood trial in 2001 for his alleged role in massacres that took place 30 years earlier. He was never convicted. While critics saw Jaruzelski as a dictator and a puppet of Moscow, Jaruzelski saw himself as a Polish patriot who tried to steer his country through a difficult period. Ari Shapiro, NPR News.
Hurricane Amanda is quickly getting stronger. The storm is far off Mexico's coast, and the National Hurricane Center says it's a Category 4 storm. But officials say while there is no immediate threat to land, it could become a major hurricane later today and cause heavy rain in western Mexico. Good box office this weekend for Fox Marvel's X-Men, The Days of Future Past, which debuted with an estimated $91 million, beating out second place Godzilla, which took in just $31.5 million. This is NPR News in Washington. Support.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Well, I want to talk a little bit about an article entitled "The Case for Reparations, Reignited an Important and Long-Standing Debate" by Blair L. M. Kelly. Now, the story is really out of an article that was based in The Atlantic, and I want to cover that in just a moment. But before we do that, I must go to our segment called Black Acre. Right now, we've been doing it for several weeks now, and it is primarily a segment to talk about this Black Acre policy form by posted by Leo Baron Hicks, which is a friend of the show, and it has really a lot of brilliant things to say, and I want to kind of talk a little bit about what he posted, his last posting. Now, if you want to go out there and view the posting for yourself, all you have to do is to go to blackacrepolicyforum.org. That's BlackAcrePolicyForum, PolicyForum.org. Again, that is blackacrepolicyforum.org. Now, today he writes an article called "The Case for Two Parents, Extended Families and the Village." Now this is kind of comes on the heels of a conversation that we had a couple of weeks ago regarding the most valuable player from the National Basketball Association, which was Kevin Durant. We had a conversation about how many celebrate his achievements and the fact that his mom raised him in a single parent home with him and his brother, and the fact that this is the case that is celebrated more likely than not. And so Leo postulated that this is a good thing. By no stretch of the imagination was he saying this is not something that we shouldn't celebrate. But he's saying that this is not should be the norm. And the fact that most of the cases we see, people seem to think that this is how one should raise a family, right? A single parent. And then there was arguments that was in the opposite direction about we don't really know what happened. Was the father deceased, or was he still involved, or was he a good father? I mean, so many other discussions came out of that. But for the most part, Leo's argument was the probability of success is less likely when you do raise a child from a single parent home. So he goes on this week and builds the case for two parents. And he said the extended families and the village. And it reads, affectionately known as the boys, Tristan and Chase were born tragically and almost fatally premature. Products of a difficult pregnancy. Tristan weighed a pound and a half at birth. Chase, a scant 14 ounces. Breath was a struggle. 4 months, no one knew who Chase favored, his features obscured, but a squig-like breathing apparatus, his heart beating frantically, his lungs gasping for breath under skin as thin as paper. Tristan almost perished from an infection. With a tiny body bloated by retained fluids, his internal organ began to fail, heralding a slow but inevitably march towards death. It is moments like these which reminds of life's fragility, its uncertainty. But by the grace of God, the prayers of many, modern science, and their own will to live, the boys survived. And through it all, the family stood tall. The boy's father was away in Iraq and Afghanistan, serving his third tour of duty. So each day, months before the blessed event, family visited their mother in the hospital. to keep spirits up and to ensure her proper care. When the time came, grandmother insisted on being in the delivery room. She would have it no other way. After the boys' arrival, both sets of grandparents, aunts, uncles, nephews, and cousins visited or are called, concerned about mother and children. They talked to doctors and nurses. They checked on the status of the parent, patients, and they asked questions, lots and lots and lots of questions. When the hospital called and notified the family of Trisha's near fatal condition, his granny snatched the phone and yelled, "Operate," a procedure which would save his life. After the operation, granddad stood over the boys in a natal intensive care unit and made a solemn vow. "Father," he prayed, touching the plastic wound that encased him, "if you spare them, all that I have, all that I would ever have is theirs. If you help them with little strength and wisdom I possess, I give to them. Father, if you just let them live, we will do the rest and raise them in a way that makes you proud." From then to now and well into the future, the family will keep their promise. When their mother has to work late and can't pick up the boys from school, grandmother does. If their father can't make baseball practice because of his National Guard duty, granddad is there. If they need to be watched for any reason, their uncle does the watching. Each holiday, as family and friends gather for Q, ham, turkey, and German chocolate cake to die for, the boys are there, never alone, always sure of their work. Tristan and Chase are cocooned by those who love them and nurture them. Now imagine the boys or any other child born to and raised by a single mother, absent a father, without an extended family. How could either they or their mother survive? Who would watch them when their mom is at work? Who would make sure that they did their homework, that they knew their numbers, their colors? Who would take them on adventures in the woods, to the park, to the playground, the library, or the comic book store? With whom would they argue about their favorite superhero? And when, if ever, would their mother have a simple moment to herself, to breathe, to relax? This is not to cast aspersions upon single mothers or their children. We realize the ever-changing nature of American society and that everyone is not as fortunate as the boys. We further understand that stuff happens. People get divorced and parents die, some well before their time. Marriage is anything but easy. Hell, at times it's barely tolerable. And no one should stay in an abusive relationship. What's more, child rearing is demanding, even under the best of circumstances, whether by intentional design or some quirk of nature. Children cause parents to fret and worry. It is, however, the very insecurity, the profound chaos of life, that makes the case for child rearing by two parents and an extended family equally as significant. While it is the primary responsibility of parents to raise their children, it is not an exclusive obligation. The village does indeed play a substantial role in raising our children, whether we like it or not. It is a role played by teachers, ministers and priests, coaches, camp leaders, daycare providers, recreation supervisors, mentors, police officers, cultural icons, friends, institutions, and neighborhoods. If we raise our children well, society produces responsible adults. If not, then the obscenity of the internet and social media, the violence of the streets, and the moral bankruptcy of the dire wolf, otherwise known as the criminal justice system, will do it for us, and none too kindly. Hence, we are all obligated to help raise the young, even those who are not our own. The failure to do so is often heartbreaking. On January 9, 2014, a young couple in Illinois was arrested. The crime was starving to death one of their seven-month-old twin daughters. Instead of feeding the child mother's milk or infant formula, they substituted cereal, water, and an occasional glob of baby food. Rather than keeping their children in the warm upstairs room where they slept, they confined the girls to the basement, warmed by only a space heater during the cold Chicago winter. When the authorities arrived, the child was lying on the kitchen table, already deceased. This tale of woe, as depressing as it may be, hardly unique. We are experiencing an epidemic of child abuse and infanticide, much of which is committed by parents and families such as these. It matters not whether the parents were evil, ignorant as to appropriate child care, trifling, or just overwhelmed. A child is dead. Two young people are bound for prison, and a family is splintered in large part because the extended family and the village fail to intervene. We therefore call upon society to reinforce the two-parent and extended family model as the preferred method of child rearing. However, we must avoid punishment and scorn, criticism and thoughtlessness. No child is illegitimate, regardless of the circumstance of birth. No single parent should be ostracized, their questionable judgment or conduct notwithstanding. Rather, praise should be given to those who raise children within the context of marriage or at least a committed relationship. And when necessary, we must support with appropriate resources those individuals and organizations who step in to breach, to stand in loco parentis, to children who lack a loving, supportive environment. As to the boys, while blessed beyond measure, they nevertheless have their challenges. Chase is intelligent, even insightful, but smaller than his brother and physically delayed. His challenge is now to keep up and not be left behind. Tristan is a born leader, but he does not understand that to whom much is given, much is expected. His test lies in the future to resist being made bitter or beat down by the burdens of leadership. But despite their trials and tribulation, the boys will be fine. Their success is all but assured by their mother, their father, their extended family, and the village which embraces them. If only all children could be so fortunate. Leo Baron Hicks. So again, I mean, this to me is a moving and striking and very thoughtful portrayal of how the village and how a family is so critical to the element of success in our society. So, Jima, let me get you to weigh in on what has been read. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think there is a place for, ideally we would prefer two-parent homes. However, it doesn't always work out that way. We also prefer people to be prepared for child rearing. That doesn't always work out that way. We prefer, you know, people to have some sort of support and help system around them so that the questions that they do have, that they have somebody they can go to and ask and not feel isolated or shunned from their own family members, which doesn't always happen. So, you know, there's a lot in there, and there's a lot. I mean, that's just not to say that, you know, kids in two-parent homes, it's not always. They have the potential for greater things because of that stability of family life. But that's only if the two people that are there doing the child rearing are stable themselves and are providing the things that Leo mentioned in the article. And so you could have the two parents there and the extended family, and if nobody reaches out to the children when they see them in trouble, it doesn't matter they came from a two-parent home. So I think what's most important out of all of this is that, you know, we have to do, society, who's ever in charge of this, has to do a better job of preparing people for what it means to be parents, for what the responsibilities are, for what you're required to do, teaching you about nutritional value and things that are okay to substitute and those things that are not, and you know, recognizing that when we see a young couple with young children, you know, ask, just go ask a few questions, because a lot of times the reason why situations happen has as much to do with us not asking and them not knowing what questions to ask. So it just can't be, hey, how's everything going, because they're going to say, okay. It could be, how are the kids eating, how are they sleeping, you know, are you guys getting enough of what you, I mean, you know, some kind of way broaching the subject where it's not up to them, you're not accusing anybody of anything, but you're just opening up for some good dialogue, and even to let them know it's okay to not know everything, you know, I don't know everything. I mean, just some kind of way being able to bridge the gap and close the door so that they'll feel comfortable in talking to somebody else about whatever it is they may be dealing with. And I don't think we do enough of that, as he alludes to in the article, with the people, the young couple that lost the child, you know, where was the extended family in terms of, you know, recognizing them, you know, probably somebody saw for malnourishment in one of the kids and why that was, and did anybody say anything? Anybody ask them about it? Anybody offer to give them some milk? I mean, you know, I don't know. But yes, you know, all things considered, you know, our society is better when kids are raised, and I'm not just going to say in a two-parent home, but when kids are raised in a loving home where the people there are providing for them not only physically but spiritually and emotionally as well, and that they are providing them with a sense of belonging, a sense of connectedness, because at the end of the day, that's what we all want. We all want to be connected to somebody and feel loved and feel appreciated and desired and cared for. And so how do we make sure that people are learning? And you can't give something you didn't have. And so who knows how these two young people were raised as to whether or not they even knew how to give love, because they themselves may not have ever received it. So we have to be careful in thinking that because someone is a certain age, they ought to know how to do something. That may not be the case. You know, we still may have to check for understanding and make sure they know how to care for, because they themselves may have had to raise themselves, and they survive, so they think, oh, then they'll be okay because I'm still here. So it's a lot that's in that article and that post, and it's really good, and we could spend a whole couple of shows just talking about it and unpacking it, because it hits things on so many different levels.
You know, one of the things that really hit home with me is two things, really. The fact that not just emphasizing the two-parent aspect, but also emphasizing the village and the fact that the extended family model. You know, he says, and I quote, "We therefore call upon society to reinforce the two-parent and extended family model as the preferred method of child rearing," meaning that it is not just incumbent upon the mother and the father, but the extended family, and the extended family being the village of people, the community people that he mentioned, the firefighters and the police officers and the ministers and things of that nature. So that's one thing that struck me. But the other thing too is that when you talked about the child that passed, and the fact that, you know, when you talked about the fact that people need to be asking not just how are you, but maybe asking the right questions about are they eating and sleeping, that kind of, you know, it kind of made me wonder about the relationship piece that we have with each other nowadays. Meaning that if I have a relationship with you and your family, then I will see the signs. I will kind of know and understand when your mood changes or when things are different, and when I can kind of feel when things are not right, because I have a relationship with you. I have a relationship with your family. I have a relationship with your kids. I visit them. They visit me. I know when their nose is running. I know when they're hungry. They feed because they eat over my house. And I remember those relationships we had when I was growing up. I can go over anybody's house and be able to eat. You know, I still, you know, visit and call, you know, the people that helped raise me when I was in the neighborhood, because I used to go over Mrs. Freeman's house all the time and eat just like I was one of her sons. I would go over to Clyde's mom's house. I would go over to Andre's mom's house and spend the night and eat. I mean, we would know each other. And so but we had relationships. So I wonder, you know, whether or not that we are, as a society, is really moving away from the extended family model, where we're kind of, you know, taking care of our own and not really necessarily getting involved in other people's quote unquote business, and not really having relationships anymore because of technology. What do you think about those two aspects? One, the extended family, not just the parents, and also two, the relationships that people have today.
Okay, so you have a situation where, as it relates to extended family, is ensuring that even the extended family is equipped with the right tools to be successful part of the village. So you have to know that in a generation's time, we've had, you know, younger parents, which means there's younger grandparents, which means, you know, the potential there for even the grandparents not to know what's right or wrong is there because of how they've lived their lives in some sort of cloud or fog. And then, you know, so when you talk about uncles used to be someone that was much older than you. Now you can have an uncle when you're 5 years old. I mean, you know, I don't know, but there's been a difference there in generations in terms of the amount of maybe younger people having kids, which means their parents are younger and the grandparents are younger. And so just not real sure that the learning has happened because you may not have been around long enough to really get some of those hardcore lessons. Now, that's not everybody. You know, there's exceptions to every rule. The other part of our relationships, I agree with you. I think we don't spend enough time with one another. We spend time in each other's presence, but we don't spend time with one another. By that, as you stated and alluded to in terms of technology, you can have two people in a room all day and not have a conversation with each other because they are glued to some sort of electronic device, whether it's an iPad, iPhone, television, laptop, whatever, and they could be in the room all day. They could be in the same house all day and not communicate with one another. So if that happens in quote-unquote a functional family home, imagine what's happening in a house that maybe not as functional as yours, or in a community where, you know, you see people. I'm a nosy neighbor, you know, and I'm not ashamed to say that. I will go out in the street if I see a police car or if I hear some sirens. I'm looking to see where they're coming from. I'm looking to see what house is up for sale because I'm going to need to know who's moving in when the sale sign is gone out that yard. I'm aware of what's happening in my community, in my neighborhood, in my church. I will say to someone, hey, we should probably do A, B, and C for this family. Or just on a whim, when I know we've done all we're going to do with a pot of spaghetti and we're not going to eat any more of it, instead of me throwing it away, I'll freeze it and then take it and give it to somebody who may have four or five kids at home. And it's about to be a long weekend, and so the meal they would have gotten at school, they're not going to get at school. They're going to be at home all day. So I'll go and do that. But that's because, you know, I'm aware of what's happening, and I see, although that person has never said to me, I'm struggling financially or we don't have enough to eat, and although I may look at them and think, oh, they got enough to eat because everybody in there overweight, well, that might not be the case. You know, I still need to see that, you know, somebody else is taking care of me. So I don't think we do enough of that relationship stuff because we don't want nobody in our business, so we don't want to get in nobody else's business. So that to keep that from happening, to keep me from having to answer about what's going on in my house, I just stay out of yours and all is well. And if something happens or if you say something to me, you know, I'll be there. But in the cases of people that don't even know what to ask for, you know, and then you have people that don't even know how to approach people to say, can I assist you? You will have more stories like what Leo referenced in his article about the young couple in Chicago. You'll have more stories of that.
You know, another thing I wanted to mention was that, you know, the relationship piece. And I wonder how much of this is really associated with, and how much of this we bring upon ourselves. Let me start by saying that, you know, we put these facades on and we try to put ourselves in a position to say that we are more than what we seem to be, that we set these standards for ourselves that we can't uphold. And so it is, you know, I can't remember the quote, but it talks about how we put on all of this show to impress the people that don't even know who we are, may not remember who we are tomorrow, some along those lines. And the fact that we go out and we spend money on these things that people really tomorrow won't even remember. And so I wonder how much of this is we're putting upon ourselves as a race, as a culture, as a people, to say that we are trying to uphold these standards when it really doesn't matter at the end of the day about who we're trying to impress and rather than trying to take care of home. How much do you think that we are putting upon ourselves?
Well, I think you have to have some self-responsibility and accountability. And I think when we're talking about upholding these standards, we have to figure out what standards are we trying to uphold, because if it's about who has the biggest car and the biggest house and all the latest gadgets, we've done that well. You know, we lead the pack in our spending, and we don't lead the pack so much in how we preserve. And so you're right. Who are we trying to impress? Where does that come from? It's once again a chicken or the egg scenario. You know, when did that start? And when did things become more important than people? When did having access become more important than doing something with an opportunity? I mean, so you have to consider all of that. I agree with you that, you know, at the end of the day, we have some culpability to how things are going in our own world. And how we manage that depends on what we have on the inside of us that is helping us to grow and develop. Because if you don't have anything on the inside, you're not going to be able to produce anything. You know, Bishop Jakes, you know, has been doing this series on his new book coming out, Instinct, and he's talking about getting to the core of who you are and what you stand for and what you believe in and all those sorts of things. And yet, you know, we think, you know, you have an apple, and planting the peelings of the apple is not going to get you to another apple. Planting a piece of the apple is not getting you another apple. You got to go all the way down and get to the core of the apple to get to the seeds. The seeds is what you plant. You don't plant the peeling. You can do that, but you're not going to get an apple out of that. And so as we are talking about relationships with people, how are we helping people get to the core of who they are, so they get a better understanding of what it is they're supposed to be doing, how they're supposed to be living, how they're supposed to be taking care of their children, their family, themselves, their community? How are communities getting to the core of the things that are the ills of that community? When you talk about, and everything is connected. You know, I'm a person that believes that everything is connected to something else. And so although the article speaks on families and extended family, let's break that out and push that out into our community in terms of, are we concerned about what's happening outside of our homes? Are we concerned about our schools? Are we concerned about our neighborhoods and the type of businesses that are there? And are we concerned about the people that are making the decisions for what's happening around us? And so extended, you know, what does it mean for it to be an extended family, for it to be a village? And it's not just about your personal family. But for me, it branches out into those other areas as well. It does me no good to be this holy, sanctified, filled with the Holy Ghost person, and yet I see a person in my church hurting, and I never address that. I never say anything to them. I never validate for them where they are in their walk. I never say to them, it's going to be okay. I never share my testimony. I never share my story. So there are times that even in being part of the village, it doesn't necessarily mean I have to give something monetarily. Being part of the village could simply just mean being in the room with them and having a conversation, because they may be distracted by all the other things in the room with them that they haven't had a chance to, they don't even know how to talk about themselves. So I could give that, and that's not costing me anything. And so we have to begin to redefine what we mean by the role of the village, and redefine, even extend it to mean something, you know, even more and greater than what it's meant in the past.
You know, I definitely agree. And, you know, I want to add to that by saying that not only do we should be looking at church, we should also be looking at home. You know, I think if we look internally first and make sure that our own home is squared away, and then when we begin to look outside, we have a foundation to stand on, you know, and to go out there and provide that. I mean, you mention all the time about, you know, giving when your cup runneth over, right? If your cup is not full, you know, it's hard at some sometimes to give what you don't have yourself. And so not only should we be looking to, you know, around at the people in our communities, but also we should look within our walls and to make sure that we take care of that. And then we can collectively go out and provide services to those in our churches, and then outward to our communities, and then outward to our cities and to our states, and then to the nation collectively. You know, again, this is a great part of the show, Black Acre Policy Forum. I encourage people to go out and take a look at the blog, comment on the blog, you know, mention that you heard it on Current Events with Patrick Cook. It would do wonders for Leo and for the show. And again, that's blackacrepolicyforum.org. That's BLACKA. C is in Charlie, R is in Romeo, E is in Echo, Black Acre Policy Forum, all one word, PLICYFORUM, blackacrepolicyforum.org. All right, well, that's our segment for now. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, I want to talk again about reparations. I want to read an article to you that was by Ta-Nehisi, I think his name is, Coates. And it's called The Case for Reparation. I know I butchered his name, but we'll get Jima to square us up on the other side of the break. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
You are listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. My mom and dad will be right back after these messages.
Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com. and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy. And I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend. And, of course, my Eastbourne.
Need a new website? Haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full-service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. to join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Press 1 to talk and 2 to listen. I want to now shift to the case for reparations. Now, Jima, now what's the correct pronunciation of Mr. Coe's name?
It is
Nishisa. Okay. All right. So I got it. So basically, it's an article in The Atlantic. I would encourage you to go out there, and it features the case for reparations. And again, it is in The Atlantic. You can go to theatlantic.com and, of course, find the article out here. Now, the article begins with a quote from Deuteronomy 15, 12, and 15, in fact. It says, "And if thy brother, a Hebrew man, or a Hebrew woman, be sold unto thee, and serve thee 6 years, then in the seventh year thou shalt let him go free from thee. And when thou sendest him out free from thee, thou shalt not let him go away empty. Thou shalt furnish him liberally out of thy flock, and out of thy floor, and out of thy wine press. Of that wherewith the Lord thy God hath blessed thee shalt give unto him. And thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman in the land of Egypt, and the Lord thy God redeemed thee. Therefore I command thee this thing today." Now, besides the crime which consists in violating the law and varying from the right rule of reason, whereby man so far becomes degenerate, and declares himself to quite the principles of human nature and to be noxious creature, there is commonly injury done to some person or other, and some other man receives damage by his transgression, in which case he would have received any damage has, besides the right of punishment common to him with other men, a particular right to seek reparation. That's John Locke in the Second Treatise. And there's another quote published, and it says, "By our unpaid labor and suffering, we have earned the right to the soil many times over and over, and now we are determined to have it." Now, that was a quote from 1861. So it goes on to say, so that's just one of my losses. Now, Clyde Ross was born in 1923, the seventh of 13 children, near Clarksdale, Mississippi, the home of the Blues. Ross's parents owned a farm at a 40-acre tract of land, flush with cows, hogs, and a mule. Ross's mother would drive to Clarksdale to do her shopping in a horse and buggy, in which she invested all the pride one might place in a Cadillac. The family owned another horse with a red coat, which they gave to Clyde. The Ross family wanted for little, save that which all black families in Deep South then desperately desire, the protection of the law. Now, in the 1920s, Jim Crow, Mississippi was, in all facets of society, a kleptocracy, he called it. The majority of the people in the state were perpetually robbed of the vote, a hijacking engineered through the trickery of the poll tax and the muscle of the lynch mob. Between 1882 and 1968, more black people were lynched in Mississippi than any other state. Now, you and I know what's the best way to keep the N-word from voting, was quoted. Blustered Theodore Bildo, a Mississippi senator and a proud Klansman, "You do it the night before the election." Now, this article goes on into outline or lay out the history of slavery, the history of Jim Crow, and well into the 20th century what happened. And it goes on to kind of present a case for reparations. It talks about how, and it uses this character, Clyde Ross, and how he was a smart child. His teacher thought he should attend a more challenging school. There was a little support for educating black people in Mississippi. But Julius Rosenwald, a part owner of Sears Roebuck, had begun an ambitious effort to build schools for black children throughout the South. Ross's teacher believed he should attend the local Roswell school. It was too far for Ross to walk and get back in time to work in the fields. Local white children had a school bus. Clyde Ross did not, and thus lost a chance to better his education. You know, and it goes on to kind of outline this and outline that. So Jima, I want to kind of bring you in here. You know, after reading the article, and he talks more about Ross and how he builds his case, do you think that reparation is in order for the African American in this generation?
Well, as you go through the article, and it referenced an article that was written and reported on a three-part series, I believe, the AP did a couple of years ago, it talks about how so much land was stolen from black families back then and how they would say that the families owed, his particular family, they said owed like $3,000 in back taxes, so to speak. And of course, you know, you don't have anybody to go and fight for you. You can't read. The police is not going to be on your side. And so they came in, took their land. They took everything they owned, their cows, their pigs, their horses. They took everything from them and then made them work the land in which they once owned. So when you look at it like that, I'm pretty doggone sure that, and this article looked at 406 families, I believe, and it talked about, you know, just that and how one land that they took from some black people is a country club in Virginia, and another one has a racetrack on it down in Florida or something like that. So when you compare apples to apples and not apples to oranges, when you just look at the bare facts of what happened during those periods of time, I thought it was interesting how he opened the article where he talked about the 250 years of slavery, the 90 years of Jim Crow, the 60 years of separate but equal, the 35 years of racist housing policy. Until we reckon with our compounding moral debt, America would never be whole. I mean, you just let those numbers resonate with you. And so when you compare apples to apples and not comparing it to oranges and somebody else's plight, well, you just compare apples to apples, yes. There should be some form of repayment due to African Americans based on the numbers, based on what we know to be true. It's not like we don't know that people sharecropped on land that they owned. It's not like we don't know that people's land was stolen from them and that they didn't even know was stolen from them. It's not like we don't know this. I bet if you were to find out from people in Texas and down south that somebody had some land that used to be in the family that nobody know how it ain't in family no more. Just, you know, 20 years ago or 60 years ago or 80 years ago, all of a sudden the land didn't belong to nobody. And I'm like, well, what happened? And so, yes, for those reasons alone, I believe that there should be some sort of reparations because of the fact that we know things happened that were illegal and immoral and unethical, but because it was to black people, it was okay. And white people was able to do it and get away with it because they were in charge.
Yeah, you know, and so what would the package be? I mean, what would be some options for the package, right? I mean, because you look at this, I mean, I'm sure there's a case that can be built, especially for these specific cases, that, you know, something be paid in some capacity. Because you look at the Indians, for example. I'm not going to say Indians because that's the wrong term. But you look at the Native Americans, the ones that were here, they have a sweet package when it comes to education, when it comes to just, you know, certain rights and privileges and some things. I mean, why can't we have a package that's similar to those or the reparations they pay for other cultures that they experience similar atrocities? Why is it that it is so hard or difficult for the African American to receive some type of package?
Because it is the one sin that America refuses to admit was wrong. You know, they compartmentalized slavery as something other than what it was. And so until America will say that slavery was wrong, that we should not have brought people over and enslaved them or enslaved Native Americans with the Africans when they got here, that was wrong. Until they say that, they will not recognize that there is a need to repair what was broken. And so until that happens, we will not get to a definition. We will not get to an understanding of why some sort of repay is due to the descendants of those that were brought here in chains. Because there is a sense that out of all of the races, it's the black man who was considered to be less than. I don't believe anywhere else in the Constitution does it categorize Native Americans as three-fourths, three-fifths, or Asians, or I don't think any other race is categorized as less than a whole person, except for black people. Now let that marinate for a minute. Let that sit for a minute. The only group, and if I'm wrong, I will come back next week and correct myself, but I really don't believe that there's nobody else listed in the Constitution as less than.
So what you're referring to, for those that might not be just aware of it, but the three-fifths compromise is found in Article 1, Section 2, Paragraph 3 of the United States Constitution, which reads, representative and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included with this union according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians, not taxes, three-fifths of all other persons. And that three-fifths of all other persons were slaves back in the day. And you say excluding Indians, not taxed.
So there's my point.
Yeah.
So when you look at, go ahead.
I say, yeah, written in the Constitution now.
Exactly. So you wonder why there we have those of us that are in favor of some form. And of course, the issue becomes, well, you know, how can you prove it? And, that wasn't me. That was my ancestors. And so I shouldn't have to pay for something that my ancestors did, but yet I'm still paying for what your ancestors did. So why should you not have to pay for what your ancestors did? And so you have that argument. And it's not logical, but it works because it continues to stoke at the fear that has kept us divided anyway as a country. And so until we really talk about slavery and how demoralizing it was, and then what happened after slavery, when we talk about, you know, what came after the 250 years of slavery, and you bring up the years of Jim Crow, and you bring up the separate but equal, and you bring up the issues in housing discrimination. I mean, you're looking at, you know, crazy man Donald Sterling was sued for housing discrimination back in the 2000s, early 2000s. So that's not that far. That went before 10 years ago. That was still happening, that people were still being discriminated against based on the color of their skin. They couldn't live somewhere if somebody didn't want to rent to them because they were black. And yet, you know, we can't have an honest conversation about the effects of slavery and that mentality on us as a race of people and on society as a whole. So, yes, I'm all for reparations. the question becomes, what is it going to look like? And I don't have the answer to that. I really don't. I know what I would like, you know, for a person who has debt from college loans, you can forgive my debt and I'd be a happy camper. You can allow students to go to school for free. Like, I believe Native Americans can go to some colleges for free in the state they live. I think I got that right. You do have to prove you can have so much in you, and you get so much off of your tuition of what you have to pay out of pocket. And so there's so many other groups that get benefits based solely on what their race is. And there's not a whole lot that we get that's just on our race. There's certain things that only Native Americans can get, that only Asians can get. There's nothing that only Black people can get. Everything we can get, everybody else can get.
More jail time.
Well, yeah. Well, no, because, you know, Hispanics kind of meet us there. So, but, I mean, there's nothing else that we can say based on what we have endured as a race of people, this is helping us to get over that and get out of that situation. I don't if there's out there somebody call in or write us or tell us about it. I don't know what it is, and I'm okay with not knowing, but I don't think there's anything out there that exists like that. So I think, yes, there is a case to be made for it. It's unfortunate that we live in such a time that people won't make the adjustments in their thought process to make anything happen, but yet they expect me to make adjustments in my thought process.
That's a true statement. So speaking of making things happen, tell me what you got going on and how are you making things happen these days? And then after you do that, tell me a little bit more about the book. How's the things going on with the book?
Well, I'll start there. I had on last Tuesday, I had a book signing at Gold Gym in Garland, and it was a great time. It was a success, and I thank all those that came out and those that have already purchased their books and that will be. You can, you know, go to the website at www.taylormade101.com/reflection. You can tweet me at AskJema, that's AskJema. You can also like my Facebook page, Reflections, What I Know to Be True. I'm anticipating another book signing coming up here probably in another week or so. Just trying to finalize that, and as soon as that's finalized, I will have that put out. But I do know that this is the time of year that we spend a lot of time talking about our summer reading and feeding program that will start on June 16th at our church in Rowlett at Faith Missionary Family Church, 6710 Garner Road in Rowlett, Texas. And it starts on June 16th to August 1st. And it is from this Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. The kids are given a free lunch and breakfast every day. They also have class activities that they do in terms of reading, writing, math, of course. Some science is in there, some arts and crafts and different activities. And the reading, we partner with the Rowlett Public Library in the area to get them signed up for the reading program out there. And so because most educators has informed us that kids lose that edge in terms of reading skills over the summer. So we practice reading every day for 30 minutes a day, every day they read. So that's upcoming in the next couple of weeks as we're nearing the end of the school year. So getting ready for that and just looking forward to what is in store for me as it relates to different things with the book. That'll be coming out and different events that hopefully I'll be able to attend and set up my book table and sell some more books, in different places across the country. I'm not, I don't have to be in Texas. I do plan on when I go back to Kansas City in July to have another one in Kansas City during the July 4th weekend. So I'm looking forward to that as well, and so just looking forward to doing great things and being available for God's will, for his service, and to be able to share my story in terms of reflections of what I know to be true, that these words will be a light on the journey as people are journeying through life and going through different situations. I was able to share with a young lady yesterday. She was calling. She was upset about, you know, one of her coworkers had said something that she wasn't supposed to and all this. And I said, you know, you have the book, so I'm going to tell you what day to go to. I said, go to day 12 because I have a chapter entitled Everybody Won't Make It. People in your circle that is not going to make it with you to the next level. And you've got to be willing to let them go and let them stay where they are. And then that's okay if they stay. You don't mean them any harm. You're not mad about it. But they just have to go with you. And so, you know, that's how reflections is a part of my day-to-day life. And my prayer is that for those that read it and that it will become part and they can go back and reflect on some things themselves.
Sounds good. Now, so tell me what's going on and what things you got going on is going to, you moving and shaking. Tell the world.
I don't think I have anything else.
Well, sounds
Do
good
I?
To me. You always got something going on. So, you know, I just like to hear about all the wonderful things you got going on. So just glad to hear about that. I'm excited about the book. I'm excited about the reception of the book. I'm excited about the people that is becoming a part of their lives and people that are really receiving what you're giving to them too. So continue to do what you do, and I think a lot of people will be moved by it. And any other things, God, any other things God putting on your heart? Any other books coming along?
Yes, but I'm not ready to share that one just yet, but I do have it. I do have a title, but I don't want to say it just yet, but he has given me a new title. Yes.
Sounds like something we can all be looking forward to.
Yes.
All right, well, good. Then I think that's going to be wrapping up the show. Any final thoughts or reflections?
Know that this is the end of the school year. A lot of kids are getting out of school, and we know Congress is doing some crazy things with their funding. They want to cut programs in the city but not in the rural areas. So be aware of that. Know where you can send people that may not have enough to eat. Know that as school is letting out, those kids that really needed the food during the school year will need it even more during the summer. So make sure you know where they can go to get something to eat so that they're not starving throughout the summer. And find a food bank to donate to give to, so that they can, if you don't know someone personally, I guarantee you the food bank will have enough people coming through that they will accept your donation. So try to do something this summer in kind to help someone else as they journey, especially our children.
Well, that's our show for today. Now, I'd like to thank all the listeners for tuning in, and of course, a special thanks to my co-host, the wonderful, the magnificent Jima Hill Cook. Now, you can follow her on Twitter, and that's at Ask Jima. That's AskJema. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business nonprofits. Now, don't forget to bookmark this site and visit my blog, and that's at TaylorMadeTalkRadio.blogspot.com. That's TaylorMade talkradio.blogspot.com. Until next time, remember it is written, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. So stay engaged, stay informed, and stay plugged in to Current Events with Patrick Cook. You'll listen to the sounds of Joyce Spencer. Sweet Dreams. Take us away, Joyce.